I want you to picture something for a second. It's October 1777.
Okay.
And there's this guy, right? He's wearing waterlogged leather boots, a soaking wet wool coat, and he is just dead sprinting to outrun a company of elite professional cavalry.
Which is just a crazy visual.
It really is. And the thing is, he wasn't like a military courier. He wasn't even a trained soldier. He was literally a guy who walked dogs for a living.
Right.
And yet, by sprinting 10 miles through freezing mud in the dead of night, he completely broke the accepted rules of 18th century warfare. He basically orchestrated the slaughter of one of the most feared mercenary forces on the planet.
Wow. I mean, that image alone, it just completely shatters the classic sanitized painting we usually associate with the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you and I, well, everyone really, we are so conditioned to visualize this pristine gentleman's war. You know what I
Oh,
mean?
totally. The bright red coats, the manicured open green field.
Right, men standing shoulder to shoulder in these crisp formations, trading orderly volleys of musket fire.
It looks like a highly choreographed, almost polite game
Yeah.
of deadly chess.
Yeah, polite is a good word for it.
And if you go back and actually read the official military dispatches from the British Army, like the ones sent back to London after major engagements, they lean so heavily into that exact
That
aesthetic.
they really do.
They read like dry accounting ledgers. You get
Yeah.
these highly specific coordinates, precise troop movements, politely tabulated casualty data. They give you the neat numbers.
Right.
But what those official documents completely ignore is the absolute nightmare of a shadow war that was operating just past the tree line.
Because, you know, those official records systematically filtered out the irregulars. That shadow war didn't fit their narrative of civilized European conflict.
It didn't look right on paper.
Exactly. The British command simply refused to acknowledge the people hiding up in the trees wearing filthy hunting shirts, but those were the people actively rewriting the rules of combat.
Yeah.
So to actually see that shadow war, we have to look past those official dispatches. And that brings us to the sources we're using for our deep dive today. We're pulling from this incredibly revealing collection called My Patriot Story, Volumes 1 and 2.
Which was compiled by the Daughters of the American Revolution, right? The DAR.
That's right. And their methodology for these volumes is what makes this deep dive possible.
Yeah, because they didn't just republish those one-sentence military reports. They actively cross-referenced the dry official historical data with granular oral histories
Yeah.
and local township records.
Family lore, diaries, all of it.
Right. And that level of cross-referencing gives us the vital how behind the what.
Because a standard British dispatch might just say, enemy movement reported at dawn, which strips away all the human element.
Totally.
But the DAR sources, they fill in the terrifying mechanics. They reveal that the intelligence was delivered by a scout who spent like 2 days crawling through a frozen swamp, dodging patrols, just to hand off a single scrap of paper.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
The formal battles were basically merely the tip of the spear.
Yeah.
The real weight, the actual leverage that tipped the scales of the war, was built by these irregulars.
Right.
Okay, let's unpack this. To understand how the shadow war evolved into something that could permanently alter the map of a nation, we have to look at how it started as pure individual tactical disruption.
Which starts with the mechanics of the weapons themselves.
Yes. Specifically, a man named Benjamin Jennings and his customized rifle.
Because you have to look at why European military standards considered Jennings's weapon to be completely unhinged.
Right.
The entire tactical doctrine of the British Army was built around the smoothbore musket. And a smoothbore musket is essentially just, well, it's a metal pipe.
Just a straight tube.
Yeah. The lead ball just bounces down the inside of the barrel as it exits, which makes it wildly inaccurate past maybe 50 yards.
And to compensate for that inaccuracy, the British used the load fast, shoot fast
Yeah,
method.
right, the volley fire.
Yeah. You stand in a tight line and you fire massive walls of lead, just hoping to hit something. But Jennings throws that entire mathematical equation in the trash.
He really does.
Because the inside of his barrel wasn't smooth, it had spiral grooves carved into it. The rifling.
And that rifling catches the lead ball. It forces it to spin like a perfectly thrown football.
Exactly. And suddenly that projectile is aerodynamic. It becomes deadly accurate at 200, even 300 yards.
Which is an undeniable technological leap, but, and this is a big but, the physical mechanics of actually making that work on an 18th century battlefield were agonizing.
Oh, yeah. Tell them about the reload process.
Well, to get the bullet to physically grip those internal spiral grooves, the lead ball had to be wrapped in a greased patch of cloth.
Right.
So it fit incredibly tightly inside the barrel. You couldn't just drop it down the tube with a quick push of a ramrod like the British regulars did.
No, you literally had to use a wooden mallet, you strike the rod, and physically hammer the bullet down the barrel.
Which takes forever.
Right. I want you, the listener, to picture the reality of that process for a second. You are standing in the middle of a screaming, smoke-filled battlefield. Artillery is exploding all around you.
Cavalry's charging.
Utter chaos is unfolding. And you are effectively standing there, hammering a nail into a pipe.
And attempting that in a traditional line formation was a guaranteed death sentence. By the time a rifleman hammered his second shot down, the British line would have fired three or four volleys.
Right, you'd be wiped out.
Exactly. So, because of that reload time, these riflemen were forced to abandon standard formations. They had to become independent stalkers hiding in the deep woods.
And they leaned entirely into that isolation, starting with what they wore. They ditched the crisp uniforms for loose, rugged frontier hunting shirts.
The shirt men.
Yeah, that's what the British regulars started calling them, the shirt men.
And that clothing choice evolved into this brilliant piece of psychological warfare. I mean, think about it. A British regular is relentlessly drilled to fight symmetric armies. A man standing across the field in a uniform makes sense to a soldier's brain. It signifies order. It signifies an adherence to the rules of engagement.
But the hunting shirt.
The hunting shirt signifies an unpredictable, invisible threat. You are being hunted by something your own weapon can't even reach.
And what really shattered British morale was the specific target those shirt men were aiming at, because they were systematically assassinating officers from the tree line.
Which was the ultimate taboo of a gentleman's war.
Exactly. I mean, it's like looking at a massive supercomputer and realizing that the officers are the only processors.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. The rank and file soldiers are just the hardware. They are heavily drilled to execute commands, not to improvise. So if you take out the processors from 300 yards away, the entire machine is completely paralyzed.
The riflemen effectively short-circuited the British command structure. But, and here's where things have to evolve, a specialized weapon still confines you to a physical battlefield.
Yeah, you still have to shoot someone.
Right. The shadow war couldn't stay there. To scale up, the irregulars had to start manipulating geography itself, relying on pure biomechanical endurance rather than firepower.
And that brings us back to the man outrunning the cavalry at the start of our deep dive, Jonas Cattell III.
Yes.
Because on paper, his day job sounds like this leisurely aristocratic hobby. He was the keeper of hounds for a local fox hunting club.
But the reality of that job was physically brutal. He wasn't riding a horse. He was the guy on the ground, running through dense, unbroken brush, keeping pace with a pack of hunting dogs from sunrise to sunset.
Every single day.
Every day. He was effectively an ultra-marathon runner navigating raw wilderness, building this just absurd level of stamina.
And in October of 1777, that specific biomechanical stamina completely altered the course of a massive engagement.
Right.
Cattell gets arrested for a simple curfew violation. And while he's sitting in a holding cell, he overhears a group of elite Hessian mercenaries. These are professional killers hired by the
The
British.
best of the best.
Right. And they're plotting a massive 3-to-1 surprise attack on the American-held Fort Mercer.
So Cattell gets released at dawn, and he knows he has to warn the fort. But Fort Mercer is 10 miles away.
Yeah.
He is forced to sprint 10 miles cross-country through pitch-black New Jersey woods. And the DAR sources detail the physical nightmare of his clothing. He's wearing a heavy red flannel shirt, a thick wool coat, and waterlogged leather boots.
Plus, he is carrying a tomahawk and a long gun,
Right.
which, look, if you're listening to this and picturing a modern marathon runner in, like, breathable mesh gear on a paved track, you have to strip that image entirely away.
Completely different.
The human body is not supposed to be able to run at a sprint through freezing mud carrying heavy weaponry while wrapped in unbreathable wet wool.
But he beats the professional army there. He delivers the intelligence, the element of surprise entirely evaporates, the Americans entrench, and when the Hessians finally show up.
They walk into a slaughter.
Exactly. Cattell's civilian speed neutralized an elite mercenary force before they even fired a shot.
Now, I buy the athletic feat. The physiological endurance makes complete sense to me.
Okay.
But I have to be honest, I read the DAR account of another story about Cattell, the blacksmith shop incident, and I really have to push back on this because it sounds like pure Hollywood fiction.
Ah, right. You're struggling to believe the blacksmith shop bluff.
Yes. The family lore claims Cattell gets cornered while on a scouting run. He bursts out of a pitch-black blacksmith shop holding a broken, completely useless metal gun barrel, screaming at the top of his lungs, and somehow captures five heavily armed, professional Hessian soldiers.
It's quite the image.
I mean, I don't care how intimidating the guy is. How does a single man with a broken piece of scrap metal get five loaded muskets to surrender?
It absolutely sounds like fiction until we analyze the psychology of the fog of war and the concept of cognitive load.
Okay, lay it on me.
We have to look at the specific training of those Hessians in that exact moment. These men were drilled relentlessly for highly organized, symmetric battles on flat European plains.
Right, but I hear you on cognitive load. But we're talking about five highly trained killers. You're telling me their elite training made them less likely to shoot an unarmed man screaming at them?
Yes, because their training was algorithmic. It relied on predictable inputs to generate predictable outputs.
Okay.
Put them in a foreign wilderness, surrounded by a hostile population, fighting invisible enemies who don't wear uniforms and who shoot from the trees. Their mental processing power is already maxed out just trying to navigate the environment.
They're on edge.
Extremely. They are actively searching for traditional battle lines. Suddenly, the door of a dark shop kicks open. Out steps a massive man in a red flannel shirt, screaming commands with absolute unflinching confidence, pointing a metal tube directly at them.
So they freeze because the input doesn't match their database.
Exactly. In that split second, their strict European training works entirely against them. They don't have the time or the mental bandwidth to inspect his firing mechanism.
No.
They are trained to assess conventional formations. For all they know, based on his absolute confidence, he has a dozen riflemen hiding in the shadows of the shop behind him. Cattell weaponized their disorientation.
Wow. So he used kinetic audacity to short-circuit their military doctrine. He gave them overwhelming, confusing noise, and their brains simply couldn't process the threat fast enough to pull the trigger.
Exactly. He forced them to assume they were outmatched. But, and this is critical, that reliance on bluffing and audacity raises a terrifying question for the irregulars.
Because what happens when it doesn't work?
Right. Cattell survived by manipulating the fog of war. But what happens when the fog lifts, you don't have the element of surprise, and you are mathematically guaranteed to lose?
So what does this all mean when the shadow war shifts from tactical disruption into the raw attacks of attrition?
That gets bleak.
Very bleak. The DAR sources pivot to a much darker scenario to answer that, taking us to Virginia in January of 1781. The setup is, well, Benedict Arnold has defected.
Right. He is now a British general.
And he knows exactly how American irregulars operate. So he is marching into Virginia with 800 elite professional troops. And standing in his way is a local militia of just 200 farmers with, I think, two tiny cannons.
It is an entirely unwinnable scenario. Arnold easily outflanks the militia, forces a rapid retreat, and captures his target, the town of Portsmouth.
Which raises a big question. Why does the DAR feature a massive, undeniable American defeat in a compilation that is fundamentally about the success of irregular operations?
Because we have to understand that the militia fundamentally redefined what victory meant in an asymmetric conflict.
Okay.
The DAR highlights a man named John Newman within this unit, but Newman wasn't acting as a solo hero, and the militia as a whole wasn't trying to win a pitched battle.
Right.
Their objective wasn't to stop Benedict Arnold. Their objective was to levy an exorbitant structural tax on his advance.
It makes me think of, well, imagine forcing a massive freight train to come to a complete stop, uncouple all of its cars, physically rebuild the engine, and then couple the cars back together every single mile down the track.
That is the perfect way to visualize the incredibly fragile mechanics of 18th century troop movement.
Yeah.
The British army marched down dirt roads in long, tight, vulnerable columns. If the militia engages that column, even with a few scattered shots, the British cannot just keep walking and ignore it.
They have to respond.
Military doctrine strictly dictates they must halt. They have to stop the entire march, unpack their heavy artillery from the wagons, and physically deploy from a narrow marching column into a wide horizontal battle line to return fire.
And doing that takes hours. It's this massive, complex, caloric nightmare of shouting orders, moving hundreds of men into adjacent fields, and perfectly aligning formations.
Exactly.
And the brilliance of the militia is that while the British are spending hours doing that, Newman and these 200 farmers aren't lining up to trade volleys.
No, not at all.
They're just dropping massive trees across the dirt road, taking a few pot shots in the brush, and waiting.
Because that doctrinal rigidity forced the British to spend half a day getting ready for a massive engagement, expending irreplaceable gunpowder and artillery shells just to suppress a tree line.
Wow.
And the second the British are fully deployed, perfectly aligned, and ready to fight, the militia simply melts back into the woods.
They just leave.
They retreat a mile down the road, find another choke point, drop more trees, and set up the exact same roadblock.
It's literally a war of 1,000 paper cuts. Every time the British stopped to clear a tree, they lost half a day, they lost men to sniper fire, and they drained supplies that had to be physically manufactured in England and shipped across the Atlantic Ocean.
All right.
Newman and the militia turned the very geography of Virginia into a weapon of attrition. They didn't defeat Arnold, but they bled his supply chain dry just to capture a single town square.
Which is brilliant. And that transition from taxing a physical supply chain brings us to the final and perhaps most profound escalation of the shadow war. The irregulars realize that if you can tax a military column, you can also tax a political machine. The final battle wasn't for physical territory. It was for the ideological identity of the nation itself.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Just to be clear for you listening, we are looking at this strictly through the lens of historical political mechanics and tradecraft, right?
Right, exactly.
Because right after the victory at Yorktown, a massive political battle loomed over the expansion of slavery into the Northwest Territory, which is modern-day Illinois, Ohio, and Indiana.
Right, and Thomas Jefferson was actively maneuvering to block the expansion of slavery into these new Western territories.
But the political mechanics of the era made it impossible for him to act directly or, you know, visibly.
Right, because as a high-profile founding father, if he waged an open partisan political war on the frontier, he risked sparking a massive regional scandal that could fracture the deeply fragile new government.
He needed an off-the-books proxy.
Exactly. He forms a secret pact with a man named James Lemon, and he personally funds Lemon with a staggering sum for an everyday citizen at the time. $100.
Which was huge back then.
Massive. The mission is for Lemon to uproot his entire life, move to the Illinois Territory, and act as a secret political operative.
And the logistics of just arriving at the battlefield are harrowing. Lemon packs his family onto a flatboat to navigate the freezing Ohio River. The boat actually capsizes in the rapids.
Right. He barely saves his toddler from drowning.
But Lemon survives. He makes it to Illinois. And his method for fighting this ideological shadow war is an absolute masterclass in 18th century tradecraft.
Yes, it is.
He didn't use a customized rifle or a militia. He used Baptist churches.
Which is brilliant.
I was so confused by this at first, but when you look at the infrastructure of the frontier, it makes perfect sense. A church in an isolated territory wasn't just a place for a Sunday sermon.
No, it was the town hall.
Right. The local news network and the political organizing center all rolled into one. If you control the church charters, you effectively control the flow of information and community standards for the entire county.
And operating completely under the radar, Lemon systematically built a deeply loyal political action committee from the ground up.
A pass in the 1700s.
Pretty much. He used Jefferson's funding to work behind the scenes, embedding anti-slavery doctrine directly into the founding charters of these newly formed localized churches.
Wow.
Over the years, he quietly manufactured a massive unified voting block that was bound together by their community charters.
And he needed every single one of those votes. Because his primary opponent in this shadow war was the territorial governor and future president William Henry Harrison.
Right.
Harrison was aggressively utilizing the visible official political machinery to legalize slavery in the territory. But Harrison was totally unaware that he was fighting a grassroots political war orchestrated by a proxy agent.
He couldn't crush the resistance because he couldn't see the infrastructure. Lemon's hidden political machine successfully held the line at the ballot box. Because of that invisible network of churches, Illinois officially entered the Union as a free state. The shadow war permanently altered the map of the country.
If we connect all of this to the bigger picture, a profound pattern emerges from these DAR sources.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we aren't just looking at generals moving blocks around a map in a gentleman's war.
No, we have tracked a sniper who paralyzed military doctrine.
A dog walker who weaponized his physical endurance to break the fog of war.
A farmer serving in a militia that turned an undeniable defeat into a deadly structural tax.
And a proxy agent who built an invisible political machine out of frontier churches.
And that is why you, listening right now, should care about these granular details. We so often fall into the trap of feeling like passive spectators to history.
We assume it's this unstoppable wave controlled entirely by great men signing documents in grand rooms.
Right. But these sources prove that the line separating an everyday civilian from a history-altering operative is razor thin. When chaos hits, anyone with a specific skill, the will to use it, and an understanding of their environment can tip the scales.
It completely changes how you look at that clean, sanitized painting of the era. The real history is still hiding just past the tree line.
It really is.
Which leaves us with a final, truly provocative thought for you to mull over on your own.
Oh, I like this one.
We only know about James Lemon because these DAR sources painstakingly cross-referenced family lore with the historical record.
Right.
So if Thomas Jefferson was quietly running off the books political operatives to shape the map of the United States, what other completely undiscovered covert operations orchestrated by the Founding Fathers are currently locked away in a trunk in some family's attic, just waiting to be found?
That is wild to think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, and we'll catch you on the next one.